Save big money and build the deck of your dreams now at Menards. Spend less time maintaining and more time enjoying your deck with UltraDeck Low Maintenance Composite Decking from Menards. It's easy to install, built to last, and you can get a free estimate fast with our deck design program in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. The HBO original series The Last of Us is back for a new season, and so is the official The Last of Us podcast. 5 years after the events of the first season, Joel and Ellie are drawn into conflict with each other and a world even more dangerous than the one they left behind. Join host Troy Baker, who voiced Joel in the video game, and showrunners Craig Mazin and Neil Druckmann as they unpack each episode after it airs. Listen to HBO's The Last of Us podcast wherever you get your podcasts and stream HBO's The Last of Us on Max.
The Last Word on Today FM.
I'm delighted that today for the Culture Club we have the author Owen McNamee with us. His new book, The Bureau, is getting rave reviews, and I'm certainly looking forward to reading it after a terrific piece that he wrote recently in the Irish Times about the family history that inspired the book. For those who haven't had a chance to see it, Owen, before we get into all your Culture Club choices, tell us about how the book came about.
My dad, who was a solicitor in the north, went bankrupt, was struck off, was pursued for fraud, spent time in various mental institutions. And when he emerged from all of that, he started the first Bureau de Change on the border, which was a brilliant idea. It was a kind of maverick enterprise.
What year would this have been about?
1982, 83.
At the height of the Troubles.
Yeah. But I mean, you couldn't change money, you know, if the bank wasn't open, you couldn't get punts as it was at the time, or sterling the other way around, because your bank card didn't work on both sides of the border.
Was this on the main Dublin Belfast road?
No.
The one that we've all probably passed over the years, well, decades ago at this stage.
They kind of sprang out of the fact that he had a few drinks one night and was talking to one of the local guys and said, he told them how you make money at a Bureau de Change. And I remember my mother coming home and said, I don't think your father should have told him. No, his was in Water Street in Uri in the town. So.
And oh, they then decided to take advantage of what was available.
Well, why wouldn't you? You know, there are resourceful people around there. You know, so.
But then tell us a little bit about the story which makes up the Bureau, because part of it, I mean, you are drawing on real life, aren't you? Your own real life experience for a chunk of it.
Absolutely. I mean, the place was, as well as being very successful, it was a magnet for every fraudster, man with a shotgun, extortionist in the country, both from within and without. And you know, my father was, he was in many ways an extraordinary man, an extraordinarily intelligent man, but he was a drinker, he was a gambler. He wasn't, one of the things that I sort of said about him, one of his great qualities was he wasn't afraid of authority, which you needed in those days if you were a solicitor. But one of his worst qualities was he wasn't afraid of authority either, you know.
Why did it take you so long to turn this material into a brilliant novel? Because this is your eighth novel, and I think a lot of us would remember going back, Resurrection Man is how many years old now? 30 years old, is it?
Yeah, over 30 years, 1992, I think.
Okay. Yeah, so why so long to use this great material that is your life?
I think looking back, there was a kind of wall of trauma between me and it, because when he went bankrupt the second time, it was catastrophic. He owed hundreds of thousands to various border business interests, if you put it like that. Not people who took too kindly to that sort of thing. He basically gambled it all, so in one way or another. And I mean, just to give you an illustration of what went on around, I mean, we lost our house straight away. My mother left her house, never got back to it, because it just wasn't safe. I was off in Spain with my girlfriend on top of a mountain writing poetry, and they came looking for me because this rumour went around I was actually in Spain stashing the ill-gotten gains, stashing money which didn't exist anymore. And they came down and they lifted my younger brother, put a bag over his head, took him off into South Armagh, North Louth, interrogated him in a barn up there with a bag over his head, and then kind of remarkably let him go, which, you know, in those days was possibly
not expectation.
Remember saying about they ran him over fields with still with a bag over his head at night time, holding on to the tailgate of a Jeep, you know, of a pickup.
What age was he at that stage?
He was maybe 1920. Yeah,
so. How did he get over that?
He says he's not traumatised by it. What he said was, I never thought at any point they were going to kill me. So whatever the tone of the interrogation was. I don't know, but
they were more interested in getting the money back. Maybe.
Yeah, I think once they realised that he wasn't the person that they actually wanted in the first place, they wanted the guy who was supposedly in Spain stashing the loot.
Which was you.
Which was me, yeah.
And you genuinely weren't stashing any loot. Actually,
I didn't have any loot in those days. But I mean, we came back, myself and my wife got to the airport in Madrid. We were incommunicado, there was no phone in the place we were in, and we rang home and nobody would answer the phone. A lot of people had left home because we eventually got a hold of Marie's aunt. And then we said, look, she wouldn't tell us anything. Is anybody dead? And she said, not yet.
And so
the flight home from Madrid was kind of a bit tense, you know.
You or your brother, well, I think you amalgamate them in the book.
I amalgamate them in the book, yeah.
But not the central characters either in the book.
No, well, I mean, it's my father. It intersects with the story of Paddy Farrell and Lorraine Farrell. Paddy was, who I knew kind of reasonably well from going in and out of the Bureau. He was, an associate of my father. Paddy was in kind of up to various nefarious business. And they were found in a bedroom in Drogheda in 1997. As the inquest found, he was lying in the bed. She shot him and then shot herself. So, you know, it's a dreadful story.
I'm really looking forward to reading the book.
Yeah,
so I've got it set aside. It's going to be my Easter weekend treat in a couple of weeks' time, and because I've been told it is absolutely brilliant. Can we go to your Culture Club choices?
Yeah.
And find out what it is. Apart from that incredible story of growing up, which has got you interested over the years, what's the first single you ever remember?
First single was Tiger Feet. My uncle Jim had a joint. Record and bicycle shop. He couldn't make a living out of either one, so he kind of came up with this marvellous idea of having a record and bicycle shop.
Is this in Newry?
In Kilkeel, County Down, kind of small, kind of fishing town. So I remember going into him buying Tiger Feet, and it's still a classic, I think. It ended up in the soundtrack of Resurrection Man, the film of Resurrection Man, where somebody is badly beaten up to the sound of Tiger Feet. At the time, people thought it was a little bit facetious, I think, to put the two things together. But
had you asked for that track?
Yeah, it was a really interesting project, if you like, that we all worked together, director, producer, and writer. And if I asked for something, I could pick a soundtrack. I could pick cars. I picked the cars. I had a Ford Escort with magnesium alloy wheels, and the set guys were ringing up going, there are 27 different kinds of alloy wheels for a Ford Escort in those days. Which ones do you want? You know, so it gave me a kind of, a false impression of filmmaking.
Because it's very unusual, isn't it, for the writer of the original story to get that much influence on the final product.
I mean, at the time, the film was, the response to it was, all the Tory papers came down their heads. Everybody was out of suit. The lawyers' paramilitaries were threatened, and Sinn Féin were tutting. We kind of felt if we annoyed that many people, we're doing something right. But it felt bad at the time. It's now the legendary Resurrection Man, so kind of.
Do you think you have a touch of your own father's eccentricities about you?
I think as a writer, I'm not sure as a human being, but as a writer, I tend to need things to have an edge, to have a bit of danger to it, to really bring it alive. I'm not sure if it's an attractive quality or not.
Let's hear a bit Mudd's Tiger Feet. Still a great tune, isn't it?
I just think of my old musical guru, George Callan, would be in despair. I mean, at that stage, I'd be listening to Steele's Co, and he'd give me sort of hear, you know, listen to Taj Mahal, or we listen to the Eagles and he sent me Towns Van Zandt. And the fact that at the end of all of this, I picked Muddle Tiger Feet.
Give us your favourite album. It's not one I'm familiar with, and I'm not even going to try and pronounce it in case I get it wrong.
Haku Yamasaki. The 19-year-old Japanese singer, chanteuse, you could nearly say. She played classical Spanish guitar with big sweeping strings, and she sang these like torch songs in Japanese. And I mean, picking out your favourite album is an impossible task. I picked out the album that I always carried around with me. I always had a copy of this and just, you know, stuck it on in moments where I needed a bit of...
Why? What was it that appealed to you about it?
Do you know what it is? It's something I kind of try and find in work, and I tell students, because, you know, I'm over in the Oscar Wilde Centre and really teaching writing, or whatever you call it, is to find... It's the strange juxtapositions in it. You take one thing and put it beside you take a Japanese singer and you put a Spanish classical guitar beside it, and then you put these sweeping strings behind it. And I was over in Japan a few years ago, and they have this way of absorbing culture in a way that would seem kind of a little bit naff in other cultures, but they inhabit it with no sense of irony. It turns it, transforms it into something else. I think that that's what she does. I mean, she flew. She was very, very popular, and she flew on the radar, and she got ill, and she ended up working as a dishwasher in a restaurant. It was a kind of fascinating character. Almost very hard to put your finger on who she was. She was never a public figure, but the music is absolutely beautiful.
Well, this track is Sasori from the Tobimasu album.
さすらいの中夕日に歌えば赤い歌声それが慰め見知らぬ街で優しい人でも
That's the first bit of Japanese music we've ever played in the Culture Club.
It's beautiful,
it's nice,
isn't
though.
It? Yeah, like she was only 19. Yeah.
And when did you come across that?
George Callaghan.
It's a friend of yours.
Yeah. He lived up the road from where my wife's from, and he's one of the most cultured men I've ever met, despite the fact that he stays in his own territory. So, yeah.
And then your favourite band or artist, you've given us Lucinda Williams and the album Car Wheels on a Gravel Road.
I think that just because I have this kind of theme of country music running through my life, I just picked Lucinda Williams as representative of it. Her father was a poet. In fact, he wrote the poem that Bill Clinton recited, or was recited at Bill Clinton's inauguration. He came up with the phrase that we're hoping history rhyme. I think that was his original. I mean, Seamus Heaney adapted it, I presume with permission. But there is something about there's a drive and a sophistication to her music, but there's also a lyrical sensibility. She has a poet sensibility. But yeah, we've always had some country music around me. So.
Well, here a little bit of Lucinda Williams, Can't Let Go.
It all alone and cry while it's over. I know it, but I can't let go. I'm like a fish out of water, a cat in a tree. You don't even wanna talk to me while it's over. I know it, but I can't let go. He won't take me back when I come around. Says he's sorry, then he puts me out. I got a big chain around my neck and I'm broken down like a train wreck while it's over. light a candle that burns so bright in my window. Every night will it's over, I know it, but I can't let go. You don't like to see me standing around, feel like I've been shot and fall down. Well, it's over, I know it, but I can't let go.
Oh, and I love the Robert Plant, Alison Krauss cover of that. I didn't realise that's where it came from originally.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
That's great, terrific
she's
as well.
A great songwriter, yeah, really great songwriter.
Lucinda Williams, okay. And before we go to the break, I want to get to the best gig you were ever at. So tell us what it was and why you think it's still, many years on, your favourite.
Oh, well, I mean, it has to be St. Lizzie in Ulster Hall, 1976. It just, Phil Lynott or Philip Lynott, as he preferred to be called, but...
And his mother told me that it was Lynott. She was insistent on that, Philomena. Tell us about that, because 1976, and Peter Aiken was in with me recently and saying about how difficult it was to play gigs in the North during the 1970s when his dad, Jim, was putting them on. But those were the occasions when it really didn't matter what background you came from. People just came together for the music, didn't they?
Yeah, up to
or
a point.
Or would
up
they?
To, up to
I'm just
point.
Wondering with St. Lizzie, as I say that, would actually have
I
been...
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, of course, I mean, there would have been people who, you know, crossed the aisle or whatever phrase you want to use for something like St. Lizzie. I mean, St. Lizzie were a big Top of the Pops act as well. They were a big international act. There was nothing kind of parochial about them. You know, it wasn't as if, you know, it was kind of some, whatever, kind of a, you know, rebel band or something in there. But in the Ulster Hall, I mean, it's kind of so steeped in Unionist history and everything. Kind of, and this wild guy from Dublin, you know, like he was so charismatic on stage. He was just absolutely brilliant. And it was funny, years later, I met Eric Bell was playing in London, and I went up to him and said that I'd been to this gig, and Eric Bell bought me a pint, just laughed like a gentleman, you know. But there was something, I mean, sort of filled in it. He would catch the spotlight on the metal plate and the guitar and kind of shine it around the audience, you know, sort of pick out faces in the audience, just, you know. And the music was extraordinary.
Yeah, we have. Live. Well, this is from Philadelphia in the following year, Dancing in the Moonlight.
It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm on the streets again. I just made another warning. I should have been in by 10. I won't get out until Sunday. I'll have to say I stayed with friends. Oh, and it's a habit worth forming. If it means to justify the ends, dancing in the moonlight. It's happening and it's nightlight. It's alright, dancing in the moonlight. On this long, hot summer night.
Great example of just great songwriting of Phil Lynott and the musicianship as well. It wasn't just a heavy rock group.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely. Yeah, brilliant songwriting. He also got me out of my religion O level, which was the next day after the gig. I had a gash in my hand from working on a motorbike and I burst the stitches clapping that night. So I couldn't do my religion O level. So.
Okay, that's an unusual thing, excuse to have. Sorry, I can't do that because, you know, all right, okay. We will take a break. We will be back with more in the Culture Club with Owen McNamee after this. Welcome back to the Culture Club. Owen McNamee is with us. He's the author of great books like Resurrection Man, but his new novel, The Bureau, is regarded as one of the best releases of the year so far, one that I'm really looking forward to reading. So let's get into your other choices now that we're away from the music. And let's get into favourite plays, our theatre shows, our musical. You've gone for Martin McDonagh's The Cripple of Inishman. Why have you gone for this?
There's two reasons for this. My son played the cripple Billy in a local production, Owen Richard, brilliant local production of it. And you know, you're going, you're watching your child on stage, you're going, remember your lines, don't fall off stage. But he did brilliantly.
Where was that production?
It was all over West Sligo, you know, and ended up in the Hawkswell and Sligo. So... But just to add on to that, there's two things. One is when you get to watch a play six times or any piece of work, you get to know it really, really well and you see the flaws in it And this was brilliantly put together. And there was something more in it every time. I thought it's one of Martin McDonagh's best works. But also what interests me about it is, say, in doing writing workshops, I get a lot of students, master's students, who come in from different cultural backgrounds. You know, for instance, last year was a girl who was Vietnamese background, but she lived in Sweden. And all these people are kind of wrestling with that, sometimes quite often kind of fractured identity, and what that is. And, you know, saying, do I belong to the Vietnamese part of myself, or do I belong to the Swedish part of myself? And it's in the way that the McDonald's did it. They developed a sophisticated sort of dual identity of Irish English, and brought it together into something which is its own clear identity. And that's why I say to these kids, it's not one or the other. You know, it's what you are now.
But what about the criticism that some people make that at times maybe his work lapses towards stage Irishness?
Yeah, well, I mean, you might argue that. You might argue that. I mean, there is sometimes a little bit of kind of levity in there, which is a little bit inappropriate or whatever. But, you know, the main drive of it, I think is serious, and he's kept that up.
Let's hear a little bit from The Cripple of Inishmahan. This is where Daniel Radcliffe plays Billy Clavin, and Babby Bobby Bennett is played by Padraig Delaney.
How did you hear tell of Helen and Barclay's travelling?
Helen told me.
Helen told you? Jeez, and I told Helen she'd get a punch if she let anyone in on the news.
I hear she's paying you in kisses for this boat trip.
She is? And sure, I didn't want paying at all. 'Twas Helen insisted on that clause.
What? Wouldn't you want to kiss Helen, so?
Ah. I get a bit scared of Helen, I do. She's awful fierce. Why? Would you like to kiss Helen, Cripple Billy?
Ah. Well, I can't see Helen ever wanting to kiss a boy like me anyways. Can you, Bobby?
No.
But so you'd have took the McCormick's without payment at all?
I would. I wouldn't mind having a look at this filming business myself. What harm in taking passengers along?
Would you take me as a passenger too, so?
No.
Why now?
I've no room.
You've plenty of room.
A crippled fella's bad looking a boat and everybody knows.
Since when now?
Since Potcheen Larry took a crippled fella in his boat and it sank.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, Babby Bobby.
Or if he wasn't a crippled fella, he had a bad leg on him anyway.
You're just prejudiced against cripples is all you are.
I'm not at all prejudiced against cripples. I did kiss a crippled girl one time. Not only crippled, but disfigured too. I was drunk, I didn't mind. You're not spoiled for pretty girls in Antrim.
And don't go changing the subject on me.
Big green teeth. What subject?
The subject of taking me to the filming with you.
I thought we closed that subject.
We'd hardly opened that subject.
Sure, what do you want to go to the filming for? They wouldn't want a cripple boy.
You don't know what they want.
I suppose that's from the kind of stage Irish end of it. The play could end in a great wave of loss, in fact. So, yeah, that when you listen to excerpts like that, they are playing it for laughs, you know.
Okay, let's go on to books or authors. You've given us the Red Riding series by David Peace. David Peace, I've interviewed on a couple of occasions, particularly loved his book, The Damned United.
Yeah.
But tell us about the Red Riding series.
Red Riding series is West Midlands that is set in the shadow of the Yorkshire Ripper. And basically, it's about police and corruption and journalism and corruption and the whole, if you like, eerie, esoteric feel of the place in that time. Was very, very atmospheric, which is the way David writes. The thing about myself and David, who's a friend now, we were writing, if you like, kind of parallel texts. I was doing it in Ireland, he was doing it in England. I was writing the ultras about the kind of the secret war in the north, and he was writing GB 74 or 84 about the miners' strike. And we always seemed to be working in parallel to each other. We always seemed to kind of understand each other's work and get each other's work. The Damned United, you know, with this kind of, I'm not sure, it's probably his best known book. I'm not sure it was actually his favourite book. If you ask him about the film, he said, I've never watched it, you know, so which is...
He was on with us last year for Munich's.
Yeah, which is fabulous, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Munich's is the
Manchester United.
Manchester
story,
United
book. The 1958 Air Disaster, yeah.
And you know, Dublin features very much in as well because of Liam Whelan, Homecoming. But I mean, it's a great requiem for a particular England, I think, of that era of Manchester United, of those industrial heartlands, and also Requiem, I think, for his father, his dedicated to his father. Who?
Well, let's go back to the Red Riding series, though, because we have an extract from the audiobook of the first of the four Red Riding novels, 1974.
When Claire left school, she was carrying a plastic co-op carrier bag containing a pair of black gym shoes. Oldman held up an enlarged photograph of a smiling girl, saying, "Copies of this recent school photograph will be distributed at the end." Oldman took another sip of water. Chairs scraped, papers rustled, the mother sniffed, the father stared. Mrs. Kempley would now like to read a short statement in the hope that any member of the public who may have seen Claire after 4 o'clock yesterday evening, or who may have any information regarding Claire's whereabouts or her disappearance, will come forward to assist us in our investigation. Thank you. Detective Chief Superintendent Oldman gently turned the microphone towards Mrs. Kempley. Camera flashes exploded across the conference room, startling the mother and leaving her blinking into our faces. I looked down at my notebook and the wheels turning the tape inside the Phillips pocket memo. "I would like to appeal to anybody who knows where my Claire is, or who saw her after yesterday tea time, to please telephone the police. Claire is a very happy girl, and I know she would never just run off without telling me. Please, if you know where she is, or if you've seen her, please telephone the police."
David Peace's Red Riding Novel, 1974. Movie. We can't play a clip of the movie because we couldn't find anything suitable to play on radio from Goodfellas.
Really?
But Goodfellas, tell us why that movie, one of Scorsese's best?
I think, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And there are many great Scorsese movies.
But also because it relates back to the Bureau in a way. In two ways. I was working on Vikings Valhalla in the writer's room for Netflix, and I was having coffee with one of the producers. And when you asked how this material of 30 years ago from the Bureau came, you know, how I ended up using it, and she said, I was telling some of the stories from that time, and she said it sounds like Sopranos. In actual fact, I was thinking in my head more Goodfellas. And for some reason, that kind of knocked it loose. It gave me a shape or something. And one of the things which runs through it for me is, you know, when in Goodfellas, when they're very charming, they're very they're good company, they're generous. But when it turns to business, the eyes go cold, and I've seen that happen. So that's really why I picked Goodfellas.
It's some great performance. It still stands the test of time. Anytime you go
really
back
does,
to it, doesn't
it? Really does. And it feels like the real thing. I mean, I don't know where Scorsese's material came from, but it felt.
Do you do a lot of script writing, do you, TV and movies?
I do bits and pieces here and there, sporadic. We started doing Harry's Game with Andrew Eaton, who's the producer I did Resurrection Man with, commissioned by ITV. We did a pilot, sent it in, and ITV came back and said they were worried about its IRA sensibility, which we're still figuring out today what the hell that meant. I mean, you know, they'd commissioned it, they paid for it, they knew what it was. Andrew's file was shot dead by the IRA, so he took that, you know,
insulting.
Wounding, I think, rather than insulting. So we're still trying to figure out what an IRA sensibility is. I think the problem is that the original script is very misogynistic, and we took the women in particular and said, you know, we have to rewrite this. We have to redo these people because to make them the people that they were, you know, interesting, complex. And I think possibly we just humanised that side of things too much.
Okay, and what else have you worked on TV and?
The Hinterland, which was this kind of strange. It started as kind of strange ideas, a joint Welsh language, English language, hybrid, if you like, set in Wales. And my agent looked at the contract and said, "You know, unless this really takes off, you're not going to make any money out of this." And it really took off, and Netflix bought it. And I still, you know, it's still out there. I did Resurrection Man, and I did Want You with Michael Winterbottom and Rachel Weisz, and all that. So, if, you know, you're out there as a freelance writer. You don't turn down work.
Okay, well, tell us about the television that you love. As a child, what did you grow up loving?
The obvious one we did quite common, the Thunderbirds. But
yeah, it's come up quite a lot on this slot.
Yeah, I'm sure it has. But Captain Scarlet was the one that always
what
got
was
me.
Captain Scarlet?
Captain Scarlet was a spin-off of, you know, Thunderbirds. It was always in the same style. But Captain Scarlet was fighting the Mysterons, who you never saw. And it's really strange, spooky, eerie sort of thing of this invisible enemy. You know, there's a bit of, they ham it up a little bit in Thunderbirds. There's no ham in Captain Scarlet at all. For that reason.
Okay, and then what about modern day television?
Yeah, Snowpiercer. I mean, the problem with working in a writer's room is when you're listening to, unless it's really, really good, when you're listening to streamers, is that you hear the writer's room. You can almost tell what decision is going to be made. You can hear them discussing it, what direction.
But does this ruin television for you a lot of the time, that you can sort of anticipate what's going to happen?
Unless it's really, really well written and really well conceived, and Snowpiercer was that. You know,
what is Snowpiercer?
I'm not familiar with it. It came from a French graphic novel called Neige Persan, and the idea is it's a train which the world has been, they've tried to seed the clouds to change the weather, and they've frozen the entire planet. And the only thing which is still alive on the planet is this train, 1,001 cars long, which goes on a permanent loop around the world. But the way it's been set up accidentally is that the lower classes are in the back of the train, the upper classes are in the front of the train. So they're having kind of sort of soirees and parties and everything. And then they're sending their goons in to beat up the people at the bottom of the train. I hope it's not prescient of the way of the future, but it feels a little bit like that.
Okay, you've got me interested. I must look for that one on Netflix. We're coming to the end on McNamee, so we asked for buried treasure. You give us a couple of things. You gave us a book, Catherine Scanlon, Kick the Latch.
Yeah, Kick the Latch is set in the race horsing world in America. Basically what Catherine Scanlon's done, she's a woman called Sophia. She's interviewed her and picked vignettes out of her life. And got each vignette is like a page or a page and a half long, but a really interesting kind of really gritty insight into what goes on behind the scenes in horse racing. And the language is fantastic. She has a wonderful turn of phrase. I'm not interested apparently in kind of sharing of the success of this book, because it is a sleeper success. But also the other thing about it is that it's part of a series of really good books about sport by women. Rita Bullwinkle, Headshot, is another one, fantastic, about a girls' boxing tournament and kind of sort of seedy boxing rinks in America. I better mention my daughter Kathleen, who works in Off the Ball, so, and she's fed all this stuff towards me. So these are her choices. But as I say, it's a really interesting book. It's easy to read, but fantastic. And it's been a real sleeper hit.
And then the finishing point is a song, Birds of Chicago by Real Midnight by Birds of Chicago. Don't know this. Tell me about it.
Yeah, the singer is a woman called Alison Russell. And I mean, she talks and she sings quite a lot. She was abused. I don't know the way of sort of putting it. She was abused by her father as a child. And she somehow not just worked this into the material of her songs, but worked it into the timbre, the tone of her songs. And Real Midnight doesn't mention any of this, but my wife, listen, I put it on for a while, said, "You're going to really like this." And she started, the kind of tears came in her eyes. She said, I don't know why. There's a strength and a... an openness and again, to use that word, a kind of woundedness in the singing, which is extraordinary. So
let's hear a bit of it.
Are you cruel to the one who loves you because you're tired and you're scared? It's easily done. And who's standing there when the anger comes and darkens your eyes? Kiss my shoulders, kiss my eyes. Don't make me feel bad. Why would you do that? Why? Lift me up, lift me up, lift me up.
That is Alison Russell as Birds of Chicago in the song Real Midnight. The final choice of Owen McNamee on today's Culture Club, author of the new novel, The Bureau. Owen, it's been great having you on the programme, and thank you for such great choices.
Thanks, man.
The Last Word on Today FM.
Open the door to savings with beautiful Mastercraft doors at Menards. Mastercraft steel entry doors add security and improve the appearance of your home. Choose from our huge in-stock selection or design your door your way with our free step-by-step design program. Online or in-store. Save big on Mastercraft doors at Menards. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big.